Now
on News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
The Saturday Morning Update.
It is the Saturday Morning Update. It is New Year's Eve. I'm Rick Fowler, Jeff Wolf behind the console this morning, and we have breaking news out within the last 2 hours. The Vatican reports that Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI has died. He was 95. He was the first pope in 600 years to resign. Benedict had become increasingly frail during his 10 years of retirement. The dramatic decision in 2013 to resign had paved the way for the conclave that elected Pope Francis. The two popes then lived side by side in the Vatican Gardens in an unprecedented arrangement, set the stage for future popes emeritus to do the same. The former Cardinal Joseph Ratzinger never wanted to be pope, but he was forced to follow in St. John Paul II's footsteps, running the church during a period of scandal and indifference. That news out within the last 2 hours. Also, last night, the death of Barbara Walters, one of the rarest of TV personalities and an icon and cultural fixture for more than half a century. She was on the air. She was placed in front of her audience. World figures, big shots and celebrities, names and faces may have changed from year to year, but hers never did. She found her way to prominence in a visually oriented business where typically women were adornments or otherwise secondary at that time. This is Barbara Walters from 1975. She hosted the daytime NBC program Not for Women Only, and that was in addition to co-hosting on the Today Show. Barbara Walters from 1975.
Hello, I'm Barbara Walters, and welcome to our program. I'm talking to you through the medium of one of the most, I think, fantastic inventions ever, and that's television. You know, I was going to say telephone, because I still haven't gotten used to the telephone.
That was a good one, too.
That was a good one, too.
And she was known for interviewing icons from every segment of American culture and society, and global society, for that matter. And this is back in 1981. And a question that she presented to actress Katharine Hepburn at the time.
Are you? What kind of a tree are you? If you think you're a tree now.
Oh, I'd like, everybody would like to be an oak tree.
The news yesterday was out of Idaho, and Moscow, Idaho, of course. It was the arrest of a suspect in last month's fatal stabbings of four University of Idaho students. Now, the news was reported out of Moscow, Idaho, but the suspect was arrested in Pennsylvania. Now, the November 13th slayings have mystified the police all along, at least as far as we could tell, because they were very tight-lipped in their investigation. But they did hold a press conference yesterday. They talked about the arrest in eastern Pennsylvania of Brian Christopher Koberger. He's a 28-year-old PhD student in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at Washington State University. First off, we have the chief of police in Moscow, Idaho, and this is where he talks about the lack of information that they've been able to release so far in the investigation.
Since November, we have remained laser-focused on pursuing every lead in our pursuit of justice for the victims and their families. I recognize the frustration with the lack of information that's been released. However, providing any details in this criminal investigation might have tainted the upcoming criminal prosecution or alerted the suspect of our progress. We will continue to provide as much information as we can as the process moves forward.
Now, the prosecutor in Latah County is Bill Thompson. He talks a little more about the lack of information that they have been able to release to the public.
The charges are summarized in what's called a probable cause affidavit that is on file with the court. According to the rules of the Idaho Supreme Court, that is sealed until Mr. Koberger is physically back in Latah County and has been served with the Idaho arrest warrant. At that time, we expect that affidavit will be available to you so you can share the true facts with all of your readers and your watchers and your listeners and all the people who are interested and really need to know what's going on. So please have patience with us on that. We hope to get that to you as soon as we can.
Prosecutor Bill Thompson went on to tell us what he could about the suspect.
As far as Mr. Kohlberger, I can share with you that he is a graduate student at Washington State University and has an apartment residence over at Pullman. He has had an initial appearance in front of a judge in Pennsylvania. He is being held without bond, and the warrant from our magistrate judge here also provides for no bond. We understand that he's scheduled to be back in court in Pennsylvania next Tuesday afternoon, and that a public defender has been appointed for him there.
And you may have seen in the news over the past several days that the authorities were looking for a white Elantra, and the sheriff was able to provide a little more information on that.
So we are still looking for all pieces of evidence, but we are still looking for the weapon, and I will say that we have found an Elantra.
So that's the latest on that investigation, and apparently that case now has been solved. Well, it's going to be January 3rd, and all of the House and Senate will be back in session. There will be changes, obviously, in the House of Representatives. And Speaker McCarthy may or may not be the title that Kevin McCarthy has come Tuesday. Question marks as to whether he can get all of the Republican votes that he needs. Now, Speaker McCarthy, to be, maybe, was on the Fox News Channel last night. And this is what Speaker McCarthy had to say about the vote and what his expectations are.
Well, I think we all come together. We made great progress today. We've been working on the rules. People want to see a different rule package. Open it back up. We've done from 72 hours, a church style, to be able to investigate the FBI and others. You've watched this new ability to bring more votes, bills onto the floor in an open process. I think this is all healthy. You watched, you know, Morgan Griffith, who really cares about the rules. He came out and supporting me today based upon the progress that we've made along here. So I think everyone will get there at the end of the day. But we have to. If we want to save the American public, we're the only ones in the forefront to stop these Democrat liberal policies. Think about it. In the 4 years that I've been leader, we've won every cycle. But we've won while the other Republicans, the governors, the senators, they've lost. So we need to be able to come together strong to stop what the Democrats are doing, but actually put the country in a new path, in a new place. Get some prosperity moving, get our economy moving again, get our borders secure, and also bring that accountability back to Washington we all crave so deeply about.
And, of course, that is Kevin McCarthy. Now, one of the problems Kevin McCarthy has is Representative Andy Biggs, who is the Republican from Arizona. Now, he was on Fox on Thursday, and here's kind of how he explains where things are in his mind.
We'll have to have that vote on January 3rd. Right now, nobody has 218 votes, which is the magic number. And I don't believe we're going to see that until January 3rd. And it'll take, maybe even take a few ballots to shake that out.
We're going to see what happens. It's always good to see infighting in the incoming powerhouse of the parties. It always happens. They just can't come in and just get the jobs done. They have to have a big power grab. So, moving right along, it's going to be an interesting couple of years with that Republican House, because they will be launching multiple investigations. And one of them, obviously, surrounds the Biden family and Hunter Biden. And a lot of question marks about where that's going to go, how much of it will focus on the president, how much of it will focus on Hunter Biden. You may have heard over the last couple of weeks that the Republicans had sent letters already to the White House, and they were seeking information. And the Democrats, the administration, pushed back on that earlier in the week and said, hey, we're not doing anything until January 3rd, and you're going to have to refile all of those requests that you've put in because you weren't in power at the time that you sent us all these requests for information. So James Comer is the oversight chair coming in. He wasn't too happy about that, the pushback from the administration, and here's how he felt on Friday.
The important thing that everyone needs to understand about those requests, what we requested in nearly 200 specific requests, 100% of that pertained to taxpayer dollars, to money being spent with COVID, money being spent in Afghanistan with weapons being left behind, money being spent with different projects and different agencies within the federal government. That's what the Oversight Committee's role is. Apparently, Joe Biden doesn't know what copy and paste means. We're simply going to copy and paste and only change the dates and resend all those requests. We're trying to do our jobs, and the Biden administration sent a signal loud and clear. We're going to do everything in our ability to prevent and block your oversight. Joe Biden promised the Americans that he would be the most transparent president in history, and I could make a strong case that he's the least transparent president in history.
Well, one of the other things the Republicans are going to have to deal with when they come in next week, Representative-elect George Santos. Now, he has told so many untruths that every time you turn around, there's another one that seems to surface. He's supposed to be officially sworn in. He's been elected, but a lot of question marks, and a lot of people would rather see him resign before he even starts. It started with a New York Times expose on December 19th that called into questions the claims he'd made about attending Baruch College, working at Goldman Sachs, and saving thousands of dogs and cats for an animal rescue charity. Now, you could see where maybe you'd stretch the truth on one or two things if you're campaigning. I mean, look at Richard Blumenthal, the senator from Connecticut. They call him Danang Dick because of his misrepresentation about his service in Vietnam. So you maybe get away with one or two. But this guy, every day, something else seems to be coming out on him, things he's made up, said his mother died on 9/11, which apparently is not true. There are now a number of questionable expenditures made by his campaign, spent $11,000 to rent a suburban house in Huntington, Long Island, claimed it was lodging for staff, but the neighbors said it was Santos himself living there. It is illegal for a candidate to spend campaign funds on their own personal expenses. Campaign also spent more than $40,000 on air travel, according to the Times, and that's a figure far beyond what is typically spent during a local congressional campaign. $40,000 on airfare to run in a congressional district? Another $30,000 was spent on hotels across the country, $14,000 on car services. And he's running for Congress in New York. It's like a local jurisdiction. Well, his press secretary, Gabby Lipsky, has already resigned. That was on Thursday. Had been expected to join the congressman-elect staff in D.C., but she stepped down, according to a person familiar with the matter. So there's going to be a lot of questions, and if there are illegalities, that will probably lead to him being forced out. But at this point, it appears that he will be taking the oath when he comes back into Washington and joins the other Republicans incoming on Capitol Hill. So we'll have to see what happens there. 6:23, it is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. Coming up, we will be talking with Gordon Chang. Very latest on COVID in China, the TikTok controversy. Jim Trusty will join us this morning, and he'll have some updates for us. He'll also look into that case in Idaho, the things that strike him about that case and the investigation. John Gizzi is on the way. He'll join us atop the 7 o'clock hour, and we'll take a look at the incoming Congress and a lot of the political news of the week coming up with John this morning. Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer joins us. KT McFarland joins us. And we'll also talk with a psychologist as we approach the new year. You make New Year's resolutions. You have the kids make resolutions. Well, what happens if they don't fulfill those resolutions? What happens if you don't fulfill your resolutions? Well, you have to be careful. So keep that in mind as we approach the new year. And we'll talk in depth with a psychologist about that coming up. So lots going on the Saturday Morning Update. And let's get the very latest from the WMAO Weather Center.
Look for areas of fog through this morning, and then temperatures will climb into the 50s once we get past 9 o'clock. Wind staying light out of the south. Humid today with temperatures making up to about 58 to 59, overcast skies, and on and off rain showers. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital. It's 6:25 on the Saturday morning update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
Saturday morning update continues. I'm Rick Fowler. Thank you for being with us, and we wish you a happy new year. If you are not able to stick around for the entire show and you have to cut out, I do want to wish you a very happy new year and hope to see a lot of you in the new year. A couple of notes in the headlines. I pull these headlines during the week, and we never have enough time in the show to get into the headlines. But as an example, here's one. Washington's Union Station shows what happens when lawlessness is ignored. And you may have heard that many of the shops, including the Starbucks in Union Station, have closed due to the crime around Union Station and in Union Station. That's one headline out this week. Here's another headline from yesterday. One pedestrian is dead, another pedestrian in critical condition after being struck by a vehicle that fled a Secret Service traffic stop. That happening right near the White House. It was at 14th and New York Avenue. In addition to hitting the pedestrians, the fleeing vehicle also struck another vehicle. The driver of the vehicle left the scene after speaking with police. One suspect was placed in handcuffs. Police said the suspect is in custody. You know, they're saying that crime is down, and there's a New York Times article that quotes some survey that says that the murder rate is down 5% from last year, and they're doing victory laps about that. But if you look at the crime situation as an example, and, you know, murder rate's one thing, but you look at the smash and grabs, you look at criminals who are following people home and attacking them as they're entering their house, people who are filling their gas tanks, and you see the carjackings around the area. Here's one. D.C. boy identified as victim found shot, burned in car in Laurel. Here's another one. D.C. police search for thieves who stole cars from Ruth Chris valet. I mean, these headlines go on and on and on. And you see the cash bail now being basically ended in the state of Illinois. And you see how bad the crime is in Chicago. And now they end cashless bail in the state of Illinois. It's another one of those things that just defies logic, how it's obvious what's going on. It's like the southern border. It's obvious the border is not closed. It's obvious the border is not secure, yet we have the Secretary of Homeland Security trying to convince us that the border is secure. It defies logic that they are letting all these people in who may or may not have COVID, may or may not have other diseases, because they're not being tested. But at the same time, our hospitals are being overrun with illnesses this time of the year, including RSV, COVID, and the flu. So it just defies logic. It is 6:28. It is the Saturday morning update on WMAL. In the news at 6:30, the Vatican reporting that Pope Emeritus Benedict XVI has died at the age of 95, and Pope Benedict was the first pope to resign in 600 years. The arrest of a suspect in last month's fatal stabbings of four University of Idaho students has brought relief to the small college community of Moscow, Idaho. The November 13th slayings seem to have mystified police, adding to the tension in the town as the weeks went by without a break in the case. But yesterday, authorities in eastern Pennsylvania arrested Brian Koberger, a 28-year-old Ph.D. student in the Department of Criminal Justice and Criminology at Washington State University. And Barbara Walters, one of the rarest of TV personalities, has died at the age of 93. 6:32, the Saturday morning update. We're off to the WMAL Weather Center.
Look for areas of fog through this morning, and then temperatures will climb into the 50s once we get past 9 o'clock. Wind staying light out of the south. Humid today with temperatures making up to about 58 to 59. Overcast skies and on and off rain showers. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
45 degrees in the nation's capital. Jennifer Harper has the morning off. Gordon Chang next here on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It's the Saturday Morning Update. It is New Year's Eve, and we are joined by Gordon Chang. He is the author of The Coming Collapse of China and the Great U.S.-China Tech War. Gordon, thanks for joining us on a holiday weekend.
Thank you so much, Rick, and Happy New Year.
Thank you, and you too. And to Lydia, I've been following your tweets at Gordon G. Chang, and you've been talking a lot this week about COVID, the situation in China, and how that may impact us with the lack of information that the Chinese are willing to, you know, really release to us on the origins of COVID and the severity of what's going on there. What stands out to you about the severity of the crisis in China right now?
Well, first of all, scientists are estimating that somewhere between 800 million and 1.1 billion Chinese will be infected by COVID this winter. Now, the death toll estimated 1 to 2 million. Obviously, there's a lot that can affect that, but the point is this is ripping through China, and it is going through at unprecedented speed, perhaps the fastest viral outbreak in history. Now, Chinese authorities have not been sharing data with the world, which means we don't know what's going on. Obviously, there are going to be mutations. Whether they're significant or not, time will only tell, but we're not getting any information, and that means that there are a lot of Chinese who are traveling right now are taking the disease and spreading it beyond China's borders. And the regime knows that. So, for instance, there were two planes from China that landed in Milan this week, one from Beijing, the other from Shanghai. And Italian authorities tested the passengers upon arrival and found that almost half of them had the disease. So we can expect the same in the United States as well.
Any sense of what types of strains or mutations that we may not be prepared for here?
Well, we don't know. And we'd have a much better handle on this if China would share genomic data, but it's not doing that. I've heard virologists say that they do not expect the mutations to be significant. I've heard others say other things. But the point is, whatever is going to occur, we're just not prepared for it. Now, the Biden administration has imposed travel restrictions on China, testing requirements, and that's a good thing. But unfortunately, those testing requirements are essentially meaningless. So, for instance, all that a passenger from China has to show is a negative COVID test taken within 48 hours of departure. Because this disease is going at unprecedented speed through China, there's a lot that can happen in that 48 hours. And by the way, these requirements don't go into place, don't take effect until January 5. So there's going to be much more COVID coming from China. And how that will affect us, I just pray.
And there have been protests in China. What is the mood there in the country about how the government has handled it?
Well, the protests are over because people are focused on protecting themselves from this disease. And so many people have not only gotten it, but died. And we can see this from these videos that are circulating of body bags. And in Shanghai, actually, they're burning corpses on the street because the crematoria can't handle the overflow. People in China, I think, right now are not thinking about the government too much. But when they do, when this passes, they are going to be as white hot as they were in November. There was the fire in Urumqi. Fire trucks couldn't get to the building because of COVID barriers on the streets, and people couldn't get out of their apartments because they had been locked in from the outside. And that triggered those extraordinary protests across the country where people were not only angry about the COVID rules, but angry at the Communist Party and Xi Jinping. I think that that's going to happen again for various reasons. It might not be over COVID, might be over something else, but the Communist Party certainly has lost whatever trust it had before this most recent bout of disease.
I want to turn to TikTok. We've heard a lot of controversy for a long period of time about TikTok and the data that could be used by the Chinese. Finally, Congress passes a TikTok ban on all federal devices, but isn't that like closing the barn gate after all of the cattle have left?
Yes, it is that way, because China's been surreptitiously taking data off of TikTok because it wants to get information to be used for intimidation or blackmail. And obviously, they've got a lot of that data already. That's a good step, but again, it is an inadequate step for various reasons. And we need to do much more, much faster on TikTok, including either, I think the only two acceptable solutions would be to ban the app outright or to force its sale to American parties who control the algorithm. But anything short of those two outcomes, I think, would be unacceptable and would pose a continuing danger to American national security.
So that's a ban on federal devices. But for parents who have kids who spend so much time and have so much of an affiliation with TikTok, what about the dangers there? How much impact this could have on children who have TikTok and use it every day?
Yeah, TikTok is extraordinarily successful because of the algorithm, which knows what you want, knows what you don't want. It's better at those than any other algorithm that's commercially available. And so this gives the Communist Party the ability to glorify drug use or to turn your kid into a communist. And so this is the reason why, for instance, the efforts of the Trump administration to force a sale of TikTok to Oracle failed. It failed not over price. It didn't fail over even the concept of a sale. It failed because China insisted on controlling the algorithm. So every parent should be concerned about that. But there's one other thing, and that is, as I mentioned, China's been scooping up data for intimidation and blackmail purposes. And every president of the United States, every cabinet member, every member of Congress has once been an 18-year-old. And so this is something that can come back to haunt TikTok users sometime in the far future. So there's a lot of reasons why this is a threat to kids.
And not only TikTok, I had a general question for you. People purchase things on Amazon all the time. I purchased a countdown timer. And to have it remotely work, you would put an app on your phone. And it takes you to a strange website, a URL. That's what controls the interface between the phone and the countdown timer. And I'm sure everybody out there at some point has purchased some kind of a device that has an app that was made in China. Is there a potential for, you know, information being taken out of your phone and used for nefarious purposes?
Well, certainly, just for the same reason, TikTok. China has a doctrine called civil military fusion, which means that the military has access to everything civilian institutions or companies have. And it can force these companies, which are under a compulsion to spy. So, any Chinese app is a potential danger. And that's why we need to ban these apps from the United States. To give you an example, so for instance, if you were to buy a drone, in all probability it's made by a Chinese company called DJI of Shenzhen. And those drones, if they're connected, send information into the cloud. Well, you can be sure that China is looking at your backyard or your neighbor's backyard or whatever you use the drone for, because all of that information is readily available to the Chinese security services.
So that could even include a home security camera that you have either inside or outside.
Yes, and there are examples of people remotely hacking into home security cameras to look at, for instance, children. And so this is not something theoretical.
Want to turn to something that I saw you writing about on Twitter on Friday, and that is the trip now of Xi Jinping to Moscow to meet with Vladimir Putin in the spring. Where do you see the significance after the Ukraine war, where this goes from here in terms of that relationship?
Well, China and Russia are getting closer together, and they are forming the core of a new axis. which involves them and their proxies like Iran, North Korea, perhaps Algeria. And that's where this is going. When Xi Jinping goes to Moscow in the spring, that'll be their 40th in-person chat between Vladimir Putin and Xi Jinping. To put that in comparison, in context, Xi Jinping has had one in-person chat with Joe Biden. So you can see the closeness of that relationship. There are a lot of people in the town in which you are, Rick. It's like a big optimism machine about China saying, oh, you know, they'll never form an enduring partnership with Russia. And they always try to find signs that China is moving away from Russia. But as we have seen, especially over the last 2 or 3 years, these two leaders, Putin and Xi Jinping, are getting very, very close together. And they're proving everybody wrong. These are two states that see their interests in the same way and both want to take down the United States. And they are cooperating. And we may think that it's not in Xi Jinping's interest to support Putin. But we should not then think that Xi Jinping thinks the way we think he should think, because he doesn't.
Gordon Chang. And you can follow Gordon on Twitter at Gordon G. Chang. Thank you so much and have a wonderful New Year, Gordon.
Thank you, Rick, and stay safe. It's going to be a dangerous year in all probability.
6:44. It is the Saturday Morning Update on WMAL. We're off to the WMAL Weather Center this morning. Get the very latest.
Look for areas of fog through this morning, and then temperatures will climb into the 50s once we get past 9 o'clock. Wind staying light out of the south. Humid today with temperatures making up to about 58 to 59. Overcast skies and on and off rain showers. I'm 7 News meteorologist Jordan Evans in the First Alert Weather Center.
Currently 45 degrees in the nation's capital. 6:45 on the Saturday Morning Update.
News Talk 105.9 WMAL.
Making sense of the news.
It is the Saturday Morning Update as we count down to the new year. I'm Rick Fowler. Jim Trusty joins us. He is a member of the Trump legal team. He is a partner at IFRA Law here in Washington. And he is the former chief of the organized crime and gang section at the U.S. Department of Justice. Jim, good morning and happy new year.
Good morning, Rick. Happy new year to you, too.
Well, we've been checking in with you and getting updates on the Mar-a-Lago investigation, and seems to have been, I guess, quiet, at least on the media side. Probably a lot of stuff going on behind the scenes, though.
Yeah, plenty going on behind the scenes that, as usual, I can't talk about. But, again, the day will come where there'll be more things that we can talk about in open air. But for now, I have to sit back and respect rules of secrecy and protective orders. One thing I can talk about publicly is the civil side of things. You know, when I first started working for President Trump, it was actually on the potential of defamation cases, traditionally what we call libel or slander, against some of the media outlets that had not been treating him particularly fairly. And so we are in some public litigation with CNN down in South Florida. And in that case, what typically happens is the plaintiff, our side, files a complaint. And we did that a few months ago, and the complaint basically alleged that CNN was on a campaign that was recklessly disregarding the truth by likening President Trump to Hitler at every juncture they could, and basically claiming that when he protested or said that he had been ripped off in the national election, that he was actually lying and purveying something called the big lie, which has its roots back in World War II with Joseph Goebbels and Adolf Hitler, using a big lie enough times where it began to erode people's will. And frankly, in the 1940s, what we were talking about is the demonizing of Jewish people and allowing a German populace to be okay with things like the Final Solution. So it is a propaganda technique, but it has a horrific heritage going back to Goebbels and Hitler. And it was something that CNN threw about to the tune of 7,600 times during the campaign at President Trump's expense. So we filed a complaint. The next thing that typically happens in that kind of civil litigation is the filing of a motion to dismiss by the other side. And they filed a motion that relies heavily on a very famous case, New York Times v. Sullivan, which is referring to the requirement of proving actual malice when you have a public figure. And that's a very difficult burden, a high burden. And Supreme Court set it up that way intentionally. And we knew what was coming. So we, yesterday, filed our response to the motion to dismiss. There'll be one more pleading from CNN. And then presumably sometime around, my guess is February or March, we'll go argue this motion down in Fort Lauderdale in front of the U.S. District Court judge. So that's a big pivotal moment in any sort of civil litigation, is whether you can survive the motion to dismiss, particularly in defamation where it's kind of uphill. But we think we have a good theory. We like our chances. We like the cases that we are citing in our brief, and we'll see how that goes.
Jim, a story that's been in the national headline for weeks now, of course, the murder in Moscow, Idaho, of the university students, a suspect arrested in Pennsylvania on Friday. Not too much information being released in the police press conference because the integrity of the case and keeping the evidence quiet at this point. What stands out to you from what you've heard of the investigation and the arrest?
Well, a couple of things. I mean, this gentleman's name is Brian Koberger, and he's a 28-year-old graduate student in criminology and criminal justice. I think his campus was about 15 minutes away from this horrific murder scene. And, you know, I start with the fundamentals here, which is this is literally every parent's worst nightmare, to have these beautiful college kids, you know, in a place like Moscow, Idaho, where you would think they're going to be forever safe. And even having kind of the safety in numbers, you know, a bunch of folks living together, you don't expect such a horrific scene. It actually kind of reminds me in some ways of the Goff murders by Bruman Alvarez that we had in Potomac, Maryland, gosh, I don't know how long now, 30 years ago, 25 years ago. It was just, you know, a horrific crime scene and a horrific story with just devastating loss. So I never quite get past that in a story like this with young women and young men that were just victimized in a horrible way. The process to me is always what I think is kind of helpful for your listeners, just so they have a sense of what's going to happen. And it starts with what's called an identity hearing. You know, he was arrested in Scranton, Pennsylvania, a long way from Idaho. And he had a hearing yesterday that basically has a very low standard. It's just basically the government coming in with a police officer, usually a detective, and saying that is the guy that we want in Idaho. In other words, confirming that the person that's been locked up is the subject of the warrant. That then triggers an extradition hearing, and he has one scheduled for the middle of next week. But extradition hearings are actually pretty rare and kind of foolish. You know, if you are going to fight extradition, again, all they're going to have to show is that you are the actual subject of the warrant. They don't have to prove the case. And most defendants, once they understand that it's a very quick process of extradition, they waive, because that'll get them to the end site quicker than if they fight it for weeks for no real reason. And frankly, a lot of times the way the case plays out is a governor's warrant is issued. So in this case, the governor of Idaho would specifically sign a warrant saying, bring this guy to my state for prosecution, and that negates even the hearing. So it's very administrative, usually very quick, likely to be waived by this defendant. So he'll show up in Idaho in probably early next week and have a bond review, at which time I expect he'll be held on no bond, and an arraignment, at which time he will likely plead not guilty. What's interesting to me about the case is you never really know the quality of investigation you're going to get in a murder case or a multiple murder case in a small jurisdiction that doesn't have much of a murder rate. I mean, the reality is, you know, people get experience from having lots of cases. And you don't have that benefit, if you want to call it that, in Moscow. And so I was happily surprised that we didn't have leak after leak, where we didn't have public comments or grandstanding by local prosecutors or by police chiefs or medical examiners. They've kept a pretty tight lip on things, and that's probably a good sign that it's being handled very professionally. Rick, what I would expect is more and more will come out, maybe not in the next week or two, but probably more physical evidence is being developed in terms of all these multiple locations where Mr. Koberger could be found, his car, his house in Scranton, his house in Washington State. There may well be a cyber investigation to show sorts of communications going on there, or even research by Koberger. So I think there's traditional forensics, which are not impossible, even though it's been a little over a month, I guess, since the crime. And then there'll be the cyber stuff. And we might start to get a little bit of a whiff of what the relationship is, what the motive was for these murders here. Last thing that I think is probably of interest, Idaho has the death penalty. They have eight people on death row right now. They've only had about three executed since 1976. They actually have a really kind of wild, interesting history in that hanging was the instrument of choice for the death penalty for a long time in Idaho, then replaced by firing squad, and then finally in 1976, lethal injection. So it definitely feels like a frontier state sometimes. They have a limit to the availability of the death penalty based on whether there are aggravating circumstances, and they enumerate different circumstances that make a first-degree murder death eligible. And in this case, multiple murders, four victims, is absolutely an aggravating circumstance. So that could be a big moment coming up in the near future, which is that decision by the prosecutor's office of whether they're going to treat this as a capital case or not.
Jim, I think many of us have seen the story of a judge in New Jersey whose husband and son were shot, and the son was shot fatally. That has triggered some activity on Capitol Hill, and for once, it seems to be a step in the right direction.
Yeah, this is a good moment, a tragic moment, but one that's been treated, I think, in the right way. You know, the incident happened in July of 2020, so it's not that old, but a former litigant came to a federal judge's home in New Jersey posing as a delivery man and opened fire, killing her son Daniel, who was a student at Catholic, who had just turned 20, and severely wounding her husband. And this bill that got passed and then signed by President Biden about a week ago protects federal judges from internet disclosures. You know, we have all these types of financial disclosures that are important to identify conflicts of interest, to prevent corruption. All of that stuff makes sense. But what was happening in today's day and age is a lot of personally identifiable information was getting out on the internet. And this shooting incident was exactly that, where this guy who was frustrated from some sort of litigation, some fairly low-grade litigation in front of the federal judge, looked her up and got all the information and planned his ambush that way. So this is not, you know, creating any sort of physical security on behalf of the federal judges, but it's at least having a common sense measure of allowing them to be protected from really providing roadmaps to people that would wish them harm. Now, the last thing I would just say about it, Rick, is I'd sure as heck like to see a little more aggressive protection of Supreme Court justices. And that goes all the way to the Attorney General in terms of their inaction when you've had people literally cross the country trying to kill Supreme Court justices. But I'll take what I can get this week, which is, I think, a good story coming out of the tragedy for Judge Esther Salas in New Jersey.
Jim, we've talked often about George Gascon, the very progressive prosecutor in Los Angeles, and we've seen dozens of prosecutors resign from his office. And there was one resignation that made headlines this week.
There was. This is a gentleman by the name of Mark Burnley, who had been a prosecutor in the DA's office since 1999, at that office, a prosecutor overall for 28 years. And he talked about how he had the best job in the world in this letter to the public until December of 2020, which is when Gascon, a very progressive prosecutor, took over. And I can tell you, I know some L.A. County prosecutors. There has been historically a real esprit de corps where they are quite proud of their work and they do substantial work. In fact, I think they're even paid better than the federal prosecutors in Los Angeles. So it's a very established and serious office with a long history. And, yeah, this is just one of these things, another moment of serious evidence that progressive prosecutors just cause ripples of harm to the communities. And part of that, that you and I have talked about before, is the brain drain. You know, when you have experienced career prosecutors that have good judgment, that are, you know, well-respected by the bench, by the defense bar, by the police, those are valuable parts of justice. And when you have folks like Gascon that run them out, that don't value institutional knowledge, don't value experience because, you know, they think they've got it all figured out in their kind of woke intellectual circles, it's a really bad thing that affects the quality of life in those places. So, again, you can't always say that one letter from one person is solid evidence, but I think it's a drumbeat here. I think there's an awful lot of victims' families, of police officers, sheriff's officers, and sheriff's deputies, and now prosecutors from within that are just throwing up their hands in disgust at how justice is being thwarted by progressive politics.
Jim Trusty, partner at IFRA Law here in D.C., want to wish you a very happy new year, and thanks for your contributions throughout 2022.
Oh, thanks. It's a lot of fun for me. I appreciate you having me on.
We're at 6:57 Saturday morning update. We got 7 o'clock news on the way with Heather Curtis, back with John Gizzi, Lieutenant Colonel Tony Schaefer, KT McFarland, all on the way.
WMAL-FM, Woodbridge, Washington, a Cumulus Media station.
Making sense of the news.
News Talk 105.9.